Welcome to Talentless, the podcast that's all HR, all talent, and zero fluff. Hosted by industry talent leaders Desiree Goldie and Ashley King, and made for recruiters who think of talent outside of the box. They're here to dig into the heart of what makes workplaces tick and sometimes blow up. They are not afraid to get into the messy, the meaningful, and the downright motivating. So buckle up, because they're here to make you the best in the business. Now, let's get to work.
Well, hello, folks. Welcome back to another episode of Talentless. We're so excited to see you and hear you and all the things. This week, we're talking about hard lessons, ghosting, red flags, and the time we learned the difference between culture fit and culture fiction. These are the hot takes and painful truths we've learned from being in the trenches. Today, we'll discuss three lessons all recruiters will have to learn one way or another. Ashley, does that sound good to you?
I think that sounds delightful. Let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get to work. So here's the deal. No matter how good your training is or how strong your instincts are, recruiting the work will humble you in the first 2 years. I'm telling you, it like puts you on your bottom. You're like, I thought I was good at everything. I'm not good at anything. You're going to learn things the hard way. And it's not because you're bad at your job. It's because the job is hard. The system is messy. People are unpredictable. And there's no textbook for what do I do when the hiring manager suddenly disappears after panel interviews. But instead of gatekeeping these lessons, we're here to hand them to you up front. Bruises, receipts, and all. Let's get into it.
So super excited for us to discuss today. Essentially, we're going to be talking about the three lessons every recruiter essentially learns in their first few years. Talent and HR is always going to be a very interesting subject because the product that we work with is people. And where we put them down at night is not where we pick them up the next morning. It is not like working with or on anything else. So like you said, recruiting, it's going to humble you and fast, whether it's, you know, letting a candidate hijack the screen, botching your salary pitch to the candidate as far as the range, misreading the room thanks to different biases. Essentially, every talent pro takes a few hits early on that really will either build a healthy foundation for the future of their career if they learn from it properly, or they will be one of those recruiters that we say might be a baddie or a scammer. So in this episode, we're naming the top mistakes, why they happen, how to dodge them like a pro, and pretty much learn the hacks from us and not have to learn the hard way.
Yeah, I love that. You know, it's funny because when I was thinking about this episode, I was like, what lessons have I learned? I've learned so many over time. And in the first 2 years, oh my gosh, it was just like overwhelming of how much I felt like I was losing. And I want to say the first one that we want to put out is that the best candidate doesn't always get the job. You might think they're the right person in the seat. You might think they're culture ad. You might think they're best for the organization. And it doesn't always happen. You can do everything right in your job as a recruiter and still lose. And that's, it's brutal. Yeah. You can source a perfect candidate. You can prep them to perfection and still lose the offer. Because, wait, the business quietly changed its priorities. I mean, we all know these reorgs and this crazy stuff happening in 2025. It feels like, I don't even know, every day some organization is reorging everything, right? And so you could have the person sitting in the seat close to offer, and now they're like, nope, the job no longer exists. That's not your fault, but it happens consistently, right?
Yeah.
A last minute referral. Nepotism and referrals are the bane of my existence sometimes, right? You know, it always happens. They're like, oh, you know what? I have this guy who was a friend of a friend of a friend, and you've gone through 6 weeks of looking and sourcing for this role. And next thing you know, there's somebody who's a referral and gets sat in the seat way before your candidates did. And you may have the best candidate.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing I really want to point out, and we've talked about this on other episodes, but the hiring manager was actually not truly aligned to what you were thinking and what the priorities were and what the priorities were of the business. And this, we could talk about this again, but it also goes back to that intake call, right? What are the priorities? What are the things that are happening in the organization that might affect what you're going to do? But that could change a hot second, right? You know, I said this to someone the other day, and this emotionally hurts recruiters because you emotionally get invested in people and their outcomes. You want somebody to get hired. You want somebody to get that job, but the system isn't designed to reward the best, just the safest and most convenient. Every recruiter eventually has to learn to manage the process, right? We have to manage expectations. We have to manage what is happening and what the outcomes need to be. So we have no control, but we control the result in like a weird way. It's like a weird dynamic in recruiting. It's probably in no other job. And it's something I had to learn really significantly that sometimes I don't control the ultimate thing. Right. I just control what I can control. And then I get it to the finish line. And the finish line may not be what I want. And it's super painful. Super, super, super heartbreaking sometimes.
Yeah. I definitely think on just the emotional resilience of understanding that you manage a process, not an outcome, and not the results. And so you literally can do absolutely everything to get them the best person that they could possibly get for this job. And they could then decide, oh, my neighbor that I've known since I was 12 needs a job. So we're actually going to do, you know, X, Y, Z. And it's harmful for a few reasons. It's harmful because now all of a sudden you realize they didn't really need the quality that they were making me fight and seek and claw and source to go out there and find and verify. So it's kind of like now all of a sudden they have these, you know, loose leaf qualifications that now anyone can kind of adhere to. And to me, that's kind of really frustrating as a recruiter because it's like, so you could teach this, you could have the ability to do these things. You're opting not to and pushing it on us to go find the qualified talent, which I have no issue with. That's my job, right? I love to do it. But once you send me on that hike and on that trail, don't let me come back and find out that you've already done it, schnubbed it, and we don't need it anymore. So that's kind of rough. The other thing that I would say, so like whenever it comes to, you know, the best candidate doesn't always get the job. I had a great, great manager that taught me a lot straight out of becoming a recruiter, like in my first role. And one of the things that he had said to me, and this was a really hard lesson for me because he always told me, he was like, you're very much a street justice person. Like if you think you know who is the best qualified candidate, and he was like, once you have who you think it should be, he's like, you have a really hard time with like managers not adhering to that or wanting to hire outside of that. And he was like, there's something that you have to realize. He's like, and I'm going to tell you, you're right. He's like, you are 100% right. And if you need someone to say it to your face so you understand that, I will be that person. You are correct.
What a great man.
But the hard, well, here. And then he paused and he said, but the hard part you have to realize is it doesn't matter. He's like, you are 100% accurate. That is the best person for the job. My dog says hi, by the way, audience. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter at all. So you're going to have to find a way to let go of that. And especially once you've decided to become a strategic partner in talent to where now you're an advocate of the candidate, you're an internal champion. So you've done all this self-convincing, all this system justification within your mind. And then to completely revert back on that, I think is kind of hard because it shows an internal incongruency that is like, well, does my job really matter if finding quality? Because when it's your friend, we don't need quality anymore to do this job. So it's a really interesting dynamic, but it's something that I feel a lot of recruiters do go through. And whenever we're thinking of the stretches that we go through of wearing the advocacy hat and going on a leap for a candidate with hopes that they would be excellent, that everything we have heard, we are assessing neutrally and accurately. I think that it makes it a little bit difficult as recruit. It just kind of blurs the line, right? Like, kind of it makes it to where you are personally invested sometimes. So maybe the lesson here is like how to create healthy boundaries. Maybe the lesson here is like how to manage being right but okay with moving forward with decisions you don't support. Like there's so many different mental exercises in just this one example that happens all of the time.
The job is so hard, right? We don't always get to do what we feel is right. We have to lean into the power of an organization, lean into what they want as the end goal. And sometimes that is against everything we believe in, everything that we thought for, we were advocating for our candidates. And that's why this job is difficult. Every day, this job, it gets difficult because we are usually the best recruiters are empathetic to the people they're actually recruiting from to, right? Yeah. That makes it super difficult in the energy and how you go to sleep at night. And so for me, sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I just wanted that guy to get the job and it doesn't happen. And that it's not because of anything I did. It's because of the organization's kind of goals. And that's why we always talk about, I know on this podcast, about being strategic business partners and figuring out how we're more inserted into the end goal of what that looks like and how talent is brought in. And I think that's an important part to say right here. The reason sometimes they're not putting the right person in the seat is because we're not sitting at the table. And so,
Absolutely. I think the next part here, if we're going to keep going on bamboozlement, I would say... the bamboozling here, because it doesn't stop with just, you know, we've changed the role priorities. We no longer want this skill set or we've eliminated this role altogether. Sometimes it is, thank you so much for finding us this excellent candidate that we've made you put through 9 billion rigorous rounds of whatever to assess them because we don't know how to qualify individuals. And now that we've put them through this, go ahead and offer them 5K less than what we've discussed. Go ahead and start the bidding at 100 instead of 105, like we mentioned to them, so we can leave room to negotiate. That is the most trust destroying. It is the most disrespectful. It is the most waste of time. How dare you say, like, honestly, like, how, like, say in an agreement, okay, we're both good with this on paper in a budget. It also says we're good for this. And the national salary bands also say, hey, is the work is worth what the work is worth. And this is it. And so for businesses to come back after you've done all of that with the candidate and they've upheld their end, they didn't take you down the interview line and say they had all this XYZ experience. And then on the last day you found out, oh, by the way, that was just AI camp. And I actually never did any of this.
Right.
Could you imagine? We would all be like, but whenever businesses do it, it's just like, well, the human who only has one income coming in is going to have to deal with it and shoulder that versus the business who is a multi-million dollar economic circulator all of a sudden doesn't have the ability to, you know, hold that 5K. So it's something that whenever you're thinking about giving the offer, if you start low, you will stay low. And that is specifically in reputation and relationship. I cannot tell you how many times I have pushed back on an HR BP because they have come back and said, okay, we're going to give them this offer. And I say, no, 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 no. I have already discussed with this candidate that we will be doing XYZ. So there is a solution to this. We'll get to it in a second. But first, let's talk about why this is such a crap deal. One, many recruiters are coached to leave wiggle room in offers. It starts in agency. It continues in corporate. And just so everyone knows, we're coached that because at the beginning of all this, we were just paper pushing admins of CEOs who was trying to get them broker the best deal for the best work for the cheapest amount, right? Like that's pretty much all HR ever was. And then about, you know, 25, 30 years ago, we start becoming more of a strategic partner, less of an admin. And so when that happens, now we're still having these legacy tendencies that are that of someone who is not at the caliber that we are. We have more seat at the table than we ever had before. So to think of the idea that, you know, we're just allowing this, I think is a silly way to do legacy behaviors whenever you're not examining the origin. The next thing, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, the bait and switch we do in conversation right now is unreal. Like, I've not seen so much bait and switch. You know, 2022 was like a candidate's market, right? Like, everybody got what they were asking for, you know, bottom line. Before that, it was an employer's market. Before now, it's an employer's market. And so they do this bait and switch compensation. And I think that ruins relationships. And I'm going to tell you, recruiting is about relationships. My relationship with my candidate is highly valued and highly, I favor it. More than you know, right? So when I put you forth for a role, I trust that I'm saying the right thing because of our relationship and what I know about your current condition, right? Because money isn't just about math. It's about trust. If you offer low, you look low. I'm gonna say it again. If you offer low, you look low.
Agreed.
Once you lose it, the best you can do is damage control.
Yeah, because not only that, it's going to spread. Candidates
absolutely.
Talk.
Absolutely.
Well, and candidates, they talk to one another. And
right.
Yeah.
How about like, ruin your employer brand?
In one discussion.
One discussion. You
over
lowball
5K.
Them. You lowball them for K, which, I mean, if we map that out for 12 months, is nothing. Pennies on the dollar. So that's what you chose to do that to ruin your employer brand. So let's reverse engineer that and say, if we had just done what that candidate needed, we would be in a better position and had a better candidate experience. And we'll see that on another episode. But this is really fundamental about how we do recruiting and how we treat candidates. I can't expect it to, because this is about recruiters, right? You want to be respected as a recruiter, right? Really force the issue on comp and be a strategic partner to comp.
Your dog's saying hi to my dog now.
Hi, dogs.
Well, and I think something that's important that you kind of said similarly, comp is about more than numbers. Like, this is a signal of respect. So recruiters learn that the hard way because integrity and transparency up front closes more candidates than quote unquote negotiation tactics literally ever will. One wrong offer can not only undo weeks of work, it can ruin your talent brand. It can ensure top talent never talks to you. I mean, it can just do so much in 10 seconds. And I think one of the most important lessons in this, if I could say it, because I know we're talking about talent, but for me, this actually really has more to do with HR, and it's this. HR, you are a resource for the human. You are not a protector of the profits. You do not care how much they will save, how much they will do. That is not your job. Your job is to ensure equity in the business. Are they being paid comparable to that of their peers and for what the work is worth, and that of a national band as well, right? Like, we're in a whole different society post 2020. Right. So you have a lot to do whenever it comes to compensation to ensure equity. That's your job. Stick in that wheelhouse, because what I see HR people doing is saying, well, their P&L and their budget, we could save XYZ. That is none of your business. That is go to market. That is sales. That is people who seek revenue and the accounting team that balances it to make sure that their operations or business or whoever is running the actual boots on the ground can sustain. Those are three other people's jobs. And in this, because it is HR who usually approves the budget and works with the manager to make sure that they're paying the right amount based on the justification of skills, which is usually determined by the manager. So whenever we're talking about who's making the decision to make this teeny tiny cut, it's HR. Not even usually the managers. Like, most of the managers are just like, this is what HR told me was the range. And so it's HR that says, let's try to save a buck. Yeah. So to those people in the room that ever consider profits or shaving and trimming on a person so they can save money for a business, which is a privilege a different person has, then I'm going to say you're doing the job wrong. That's not it.
Yeah,
that's not it.
I completely agree. I mean, we're in the freaking people business, people. People, not business. People. We should be looking out for people to be in the right seat. And Ashley and I will talk about this over and over and over again. The need for a human-centered talent function and human-centered HR function is essential. We're losing that through so many other things that we're doing. We're not really being that empathetic, really integrity leader right now. And if you can't find that way to do this job, I'm going to tell you, get out.
Yeah.
It's the way this job should be done every single day. And this goes into my next point. Ashley and I, you know, we always talk about this, and probably the audience is like, oh my God, we've heard you say this like 17 times. But I want to talk about us being a strategic partner, right? Mm. Right. And the only way that recruiters actually do that is if you force the issue to do it. Like, no one's going to say like, hey, talent, come on in.
Yeah.
They're not going to do it because talent is, it's a little kid's table. Always. Right. Always. So you have to force your way into that system. And it's a really great system if you want to learn it. Right. You take it by knowing the numbers. You know the business. You know what's happening. You know what's happening in every the departments you support. And we've always said, and I will say this over and over again, if you don't know the business that you support better than the business, how are you being a partner to the business? Yeah. Right? Yeah. And so that means speaking in business speak. I don't care if you went to college. I don't care if you only have a high school degree. I don't really care if you went to trade school. You can learn these business terms that your organization speaks to, right? If the EBITDA is important to them. I know. I don't even know what it's called. If the EBITDA is important to them. If the, you know, whatever their margins are important to them, you should be able to speak that speak.
Yeah. Right? So we have to be fluent in the same languages.
Right. Yeah. And then we also have to push back on hiring managers, because I don't think we do that enough.
So, and just to add on to exactly what you're saying, so looking at the last example of leaving that room for negotiation because HR said so. So like, for me, I have found over the years, I do one very specific response whenever they send me that. And I specifically say to them, is there a reason that we would no longer offer them the amount that we all agreed the work was worth? ? And what that prompts them to do is have to define, did the work change? Did the individual's qualifications change? Did we learn that they were less than what we actually thought they were whenever we agreed to this at the first point? So even that simple pushing back to make them define a reason, a motivation for this logic and this decision, just a simple why. That alone has probably cut HR people making me negotiate down a candidate over 75% of the time. Because at the end of the day, they don't have an answer.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if you push back on the why, you get no answer, which is also an answer. Right. Yeah. Right. And so do you, and this is a question for you, because I believe this, I believe wholeheartedly, and I know you do too, but I'm going to ask this to you anyway, you know, how much does data influence you going to a hiring manager? Like, do you use backup data or Glassdoor or comp or surveys, or like, how do you really approach that? Or do you just ask the question why?
This episode is brought to you by DEI Labs, re-educating corporate America with immersive data-driven DEI training for HR and hiring pros. Ready to shift systems and spark real change? Visit DEI-labs.com to get started. Need a resume that actually works? Resume Writing is a female-owned team of recruiting pros helping job seekers land the roles they deserve. Get expert help at resumewriting.com.
Great question. So it really depends. Like, if they're trying to take it down more than K, then yeah, I'm going to show up with a little bit of research, because that to me would mean that there's something bigger. Like, there would need to be a reason. Right. So I'm going to hit them with the same question, no matter what, like, what has changed? And the reason I ask that specific question is because if you just ask why, then they can be like, well, we didn't really think XYZ. And now that we've reevaluated the budget, they can do all these external factors. Right? But if you ask them very specifically, what changed between point A and point B to make you change your mind? And that is so specific that half the time they really can't answer. So I will say this to recruiters, depending on your relationship with your HRBP, if you think that it's clean cut enough to just ask one question and not have to put any more legwork, great. If it is something to where maybe you aren't that close with the HRBP and the manager, and you do want to have this conversation in a fruitful way, then absolutely absolutely. You need to be meeting them with the research that supports why we made this claim that we would pay this much. Your budget agreed that the work was worth this much, and we found a candidate in line for that much. So all three of us agreed at one point, and now it's scattered. So that's why I would say be prepared to come with data always, and know how to look it up, know how to do a very simple comp analysis. It usually is Glassdoor, Payscale, salary.com. Like, I would say you're doing a meta-analysis of about 6 different websites or more to see what a conglomerate of these different salary bands look like per that location is essentially what you're providing.
Funny too, I was prepping for this call and I was thinking to myself, how many recruiters do I think actually do comp analysis when they're looking at a role? And I had to say to myself, I don't think that many.
No, I don't think a lot of people actually know how to do it. Right. If I'm being quite frank, like even just me saying it's a quick meta analysis from 6 or more sites, people are like, that's it. And it's like, you just have to do your homework. Now there are tools that do all this for you and have that background data and you can put it in. But if you're doing this organically, you're not given tools and you're just here to support, maybe the salary range is too low and you need to provide to them, one, market feedback that all the candidates are saying it's too low. But two, you need to provide that third party feedback of like, what's the general consensus outside of our, our candidate pool saying as well. Yeah. And at that point, that's whenever anything more than I would say 4 or 5 data points, that can give you a decent consolidation. But there are certain parameters around that as well. You got to make sure that you're hitting on the right thing whenever you're searching. Because it's not just searching a job title. It's skills.
Was having a conversation the other day, and I was thinking about this about, you know, and we were talking about this with Mike Ditto, Pedito, about this the other day. Sorry, I can never say his name right. Sorry, Mike.
Pedita and Pedito.
But, I think that, we let a lot of people into this field and didn't give them any training. And he said that it hit me hard, right? Because people have gotten into this field without a ton of training. And it really resonated with me that I may be talking to a blind audience, that we're going to have this whole episode and they're going to be like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm doing fine in my job.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing great, because they don't know what better looks like. And that's a real thing. And so I just want to be cognizant of that, there's a lot of recruiters out there that don't have a lot of training, and we're here to help, right?
Yeah. So just to be clear, that's 100% of why I made DEI Labs. I know it's called DEI Labs. I know that we focused on how recruiters do DEI because it was so problematic. But here's what I found by looking at it from that angle. It's problematic everywhere, because unless you're getting your degree in IO psychology, it's not just talent doing DEI that we're effing up. It's talent doing talent infrastructure. It's the how we're doing talent mobility and integration. It's how we're wording job descriptions and not paying attention to disparate impact. It's the fact that whenever I say disparate impact, half the recruiters don't even know what that means. That shit terrifies me. Sorry for the curse word, family, but it really does, because the fact that we have this many people having this much hand on such a significant thing, I mean, they're literally the only hands that touch the money clip that keep the economy going around. They're the only consistent one layer. There's business owners and HR. They help. The number one cost of a business is salary. So the number one export of money is being decided by HR.
Yeah.
So,
And I'll say this, because there have been a lot of layoffs, and this probably episode won't air until some of these layoffs seem like they've gone by. But we had some significant layoffs in the last week from Microsoft and LinkedIn and some other places. I just want to say that, as you take your journey through recruiting, proving your value is really has to be a journey for you alone, not just your organization. Mm. So get into the data, get into how you become a strategic business partner, right? Get into all of these things, because the more you can hold value as a partner to the business, the more you're indispensable. And I had to learn that, and probably 5 years in, had to learn that the way I was indispensable is because I was always trying to fix a process, or I knew the data behind something, or I knew how to do something else. And it's not just putting candidates in the seat. And I think it's really important for people and recruiters getting laid off right now that they understand the value they hold and really try to up their skills.
Yeah, but it's an interesting thought to think about whenever recruiters do know the value that they hold, but perhaps maybe their business doesn't.
I agree.
What this point really reminded me of the most, as far as, you know, no one gives you a seat at the table, you take it by knowing the business better than they do. And so I had an experience where, you know, you can be the best recruiter in the organization and still be treated like as if you don't matter. There was a company that I worked with, and I was dealing with executives, and this was a tech SaaS startup, and they had never worked with talent before. Even before they started the startup, they were doing something to where they weren't in management. So they had no relation with HR and talent. So they had no idea what good was. And for this specific company, I was working over, I'm not even going to tell you all the real amount of hours. I'm just going to say over 80 hours a week, because I was. And that was a minimum, if I'm being quite frank. And it was crazy because we had data points. Our LinkedIn salesperson came to us, wrote us up a whole entire letter because I was the top 1% user in recruitment. So much so that I had such a high rate that they actually had me do like a talk for their salespeople on what I'm doing so they can get their different clients to start using it as much as I was, right? So it's like I had a significant value, but only to the people who understood its worth.
Yeah.
And so in my own house with the C-suite that I was dealing with, they had no valuation of my skill.
Right.
And it was the craziest thing because I'm getting awards. I'm getting paid by LinkedIn to teach other people how to do what I'm doing. And my own company is like, I don't know if she's meeting the mark. And that was really difficult for me because I knew my worth and I knew how good I was. So what ended up happening is we eventually got a fractional COO from Google. And that individual had highly worked with talent because they were VP of operations at Google. And so they actually pulled our data out of Greenhouse, took it over to, I'm not going to say his name, but the head of talent over there at Google and said, hey, can you tell me how this sits per capita based off of herself and then how many recruiters she's managing and everything like that? And they said to him, we don't have a single person that has ever done this amount of performance in any of our stuff. So then they took it back, set it to the CEO, and I'm telling you, everything changed. I got a bonus. I got a promotion. Wow. Nothing about me changed. Nothing about my work changed. My work product didn't. The only thing that changed was their perspective on what I was doing.
Wow.
And I think it's an interesting dichotomy because that's not usually the case, right? Like whenever you're good, the idea is that you get valued. But what if you get that? Like, how do you seek value from people who think talent is valueless?
Right.
And that a lot of people,
it's very difficult. This is, I say it goes back to in the numbers. If you listen, I'm a P&L champion. I can read a P&L like anybody's business right now because talent made me do that, right? It made me understand the P&L. And I was able to say to somebody, like, we're not meeting the mark here, here, and here. Here's the P&L and here's what's happening. I think if you educate yourself on the actual organization business, you become a little more invaluable. I'm not saying it stops the problem, right? Because talent is still the little kid's table, right? Always. We would like to change that on this show, but it is still the little kid's table. But the more you educate yourself about the organization and the business and what's happening, the more you're able to come to these meetings and say, you know, hey, listen, this is what's valuable and here it, how it affects your P&L, here how it affects your balance sheet, here it affects your equity, all the things that we don't normally talk about in talent because we're just sitting somebody in the seat. We need to be talking about more and we're not doing that. And we're and this is why we continue to be, to me, sitting at the little kids table. And so if I could say anything to anybody in the first 2 years of learning recruiting, with your campus recruiting, whether you're, you know, doing high volume, I don't care what it is, learn the business. Because yes, you're putting people in the seat, but you need to learn who you're hiring for, the business, the industry, the sector, because that is so important to how you hold value for yourself. Otherwise, you get sidelined. You immediately get put to the little kids table, and we don't want to sit there anymore. Talentless says we don't want to sit there anymore. That's not what this podcast is about. We want to sit at the big kids table, and we should be there.
Yeah, but you can't say goo goo gaga at the big kids table. You got to speak their language. You have to speak their language.
Right. You cannot say goo goo gaga, you know, I'm speaking this LinkedIn speak. No one cares. And I love that we care as a community, but no one cares beyond talent. And so you have to learn the language of the business.
You have to make yourself valuable.
It's a whole different mindset. It really does. If someone had told me that the first 2 years in, I promise you I'd be a different recruiter today. It took me years to learn that. And when I finally learned it, I became the recruiter I am today. And
good for you.
You know, people ask for me. Because I know what the business needs. I know how to speak their speak. And when I get into, and I take clients right now, so everybody knows I'm not an internal recruiter. I go in and I have to figure out somebody's business in like 5 minutes.
For
sure. But I do all my research and all my deep dives, and then I'm able to speak to them on their language. I might not have a P&L, but I can speak to what the business needs. And I think it's super, super important. I can't stress it enough.
Well, it's the number one way you're going to build trust with the managers, too. I think one of the biggest mistakes, if we're talking about mistakes and lessons learned, is recruiters don't take time to build trust with their managers. Yes. They don't take time to make sure their managers know that they know what they're doing. And so many times I've heard managers be like, my recruiter doesn't know what they're doing. They don't know how to. And it's because the recruiter never took this verification point of showing them, you know, qualified candidates that they've sourced or any way to say, hey, here's my work, double check this. So that way, you know, you have that double pat and you know that it's going to be quality. Yeah. And that like never happens. Recruiters are just like, all right, I'll just do my thing and applications come and blah, blah, blah. And so the biggest mistake you can make and the best thing you can do is to build that trust up front, address those concerns, questions straight away, because that saves you so much on the back end. And especially whenever those business people at that business table you're not allowed at, ask the manager how it's going. They're the only ones that can speak for you at that table until you get there. So unless you're feeding them exactly how to do and say this, which you can't do if they don't trust you, then the only thing that's going to be spoken about you at that table is not what you're going to want to have out there. So protect your reputation at the table by getting internal champions there. And those are your hiring managers. That's how you do this.
I always say, like, be a SME, right? Like,
be a SME.
It's me. And that takes work, right? Oh, it doesn't take like I'm just a SME because I hired some people, right? You actually have to do work to be a SME in recruiting. So do your research, take the time, really invest in your career and who you are as a recruiter. I don't think we're going to say that enough on this show, but honestly, take the time and be really present for how you do your job every day and what you represent to that organization, because they're not going to always love you.
Word.
Because they don't always love you. You know, be that person and be present for them and do your research and be educated.
Yeah, recruiters.
Recruiters.
Yeah, good recruiters. We just want y'all to be the best. What's so
wrong? We want you to be the best in the business. This is the time of this podcast that we talk about stuff you didn't know before. This is the psychological side of what we're talking about. And so we get into Ashley King to give us those notes. Ashley?
Thank you, Desiree. Today, we are discussing how humans learn and why some lessons stick the first time and all the rest do not, and what you can do as a leader to help influence those around you to learn the lesson the first time. So in order to understand how lessons work, I think it's best that we go through the two things that impact the person's ability to learn and retain lessons. So these two things are, one, encoding deeply into memory. So whenever we're talking about encoding, that means like whenever you have a memory, sometimes things will be slipping out of your mind, other times they'll stay. For instance, if I was to say right now, Desiree, in West Philadelphia, born and raised, you would say,
I don't know, the rest of my day.
Are you joking? You don't stop the show. If I said in West Philadelphia, born and raised,
I don't know, I'm from Philly. I mean, it's
this,
like,
is absolute trash.
I know, I'm so trash. I'm sorry.
No, not you. Okay, what if I said, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
What?
Guys, I have to quit. Consider this my severance letter.
Listen, she's trying to make me do references. I don't even know what's happening. I don't
ever. I was trying to
try for Ashley in her, like, decade references.
You know something? Every single person listening to this right now is screaming at their radio or headphones, being like, on the playground is where I spent most of my days.
Here, I said most of my days. Do you know what? My wife will tell you. She always laughs at me because I do not know the words to songs. I know songs. But I can go, like, sing the rhythm. I know.
All right, audience. That again. Well, Listen, had this had gone appropriately, what would have happened, all right? I thought you were a culture queen, too. My gosh. Okay, well, Fresh Prince is pissed, all right?
And I know. He's probably really mad at me.
I know. You know how often Will listens to us. Yeah, him and Jada. They're about to be banging on our
door. Yeah, they're so mad. They're so mad right now.
I know. He's going to slap me like Chris Rock. Why'd you bring Jada into this? Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so back to reality right now, all right? What I was trying to do is once I sing that song, 99% of America, except for Desiree Goldie, would know that the next lines are, in West Philadelphia, born and raised on the playground is where I spend most of my days. The reason that I bring up this explanation is because that line is deeply encoded in your memory. It was not in the front of your mind, but the moment that I said the first part of the line, 99% of the world was able to then pull out in their memory the next sentence of the song. And so that's what encoded deeply means. It's in your long-term memory. It's not in your front of mind, but you're going to have a recall. So I did want to explain that specific term of encodement, and specifically a deep encodement. And so what can make something deeply encoded is whenever it is with emotion. So especially if that emotion is embarrassment, pride, shame, whatever it is that's going on. If you want to help that lesson burn into long-term memory, it needs to be paired with a type of emotion. The other thing that helps make lessons stick, besides making it emotional and real, is to tie every lesson to a real story, a personal consequence, why it matters. People remember what hurts or helps them as a human and how it would affect them as a person. So let's celebrate changed behavior, because that also helps encourage it as well. Not just outcomes, but the honest reward of learning and evolution, right? So, like, we don't just want to see people repeating. We want to see changed behavior. So remember, the best ways to do this, as far as, you know, ensuring that your recruiters and anyone around you or who works for you can remember some deep lessons, the number one thing you have to do that makes a lesson stick is to get it deeply encoded. The best way to do that is to pair the lesson with an emotion, a story, a personal tie, and that will give it the stickiness that it needs to hopefully eventually change behavior. And once those cycles start beginning, it is now your job to ensure rewarding it so that way it continues. All right, this is stuff you didn't know before, and I know you didn't know it because Desiree didn't know it, and I'm talking about the song. I can't get past
it. I'm gonna know it next
time. We're moving past it. We're gonna see y'all later.
We're no longer friends, by the way, guys.
People are gonna freak out. Wait till they hear the next episode.
We are so excited that you joined us today, and thank you for sitting in for Talent Tales, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
I'm Desiree.
And I'm Ashley. And thanks for listening to Talentless, where we keep it real in the world of HR.
If you loved what you heard, don't forget to hit subscribe and give us a follow on Blue Sky, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We're here to keep your feed packed with everything you need to level up in recruitment and HR.
And be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And hey, don't miss out. Sign up for our newsletter for fresh insights and follow us on socials to stay connected with both Ashley and me.
Thanks again for joining us on Talentless. Until next time, we'll see you then.